I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from University Notre Dame, Australia. Welcome back, Martin.
It's always good to be here, Michael.
It's good to be here, but I tell you what, the rest of the world, Martin, I'm not so sure about. Everybody sort of remembers and sings the first sort of stanza, the first verse of Barry Maguire's famous Eve of Destruction, but the second doesn't get enough of a run, Martin. It goes like this. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, how you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Now, I know I shouldn't have done that because the record companies will be trying to sign me up very, very quickly. But Martin, tell me, you don't believe that we're on the eve of destruction? Charlie gets shot, gets assassinated. He's a youthful right-wing commentator, mate of Trump's. You can't do this sort of thing. Is it just America, imploding? Is not the world imploding?
I find that's very disturbing. And I think we need to leave behind any particular political persuasion that we might have. And just to look at, strip it down, it's not about the views that a person might hold. It's the fact that they can't front up to a university or any other place, express those views without being shot. Political violence tears away at the fabric of every democracy. It's profoundly disturbing because democracies only function because people have different views and they'll tolerate views that are different to themselves. So, and it's not the first time it's happened in the US, and it's not the first time it's happened recently in the US. So we had two attempted assassinations of Trump himself, but we also had, a Minnesota senator, a state senator who was Democratic. I think there was an attempted assassination of Gabrielle Giffords from another Democrat senator, and there's been a lot of political violence on both sides of politics. Firstly, why would you go into politics in the U.S., Michael? But I think it's this hyper polarization in the U.S. where you can't have a view that's you can't tolerate someone that has a different view. You won't have a democracy if you continue doing that. And I'm also a bit worried that there might be re recriminations. There'll be a lot of people upset by this. Will some of them try and use violence? Violence tends to beget violence. So it's a profoundly disturbing development, in my view.
It has to be said, the assassination of Charlie Kirk is going to beget more violence. Already, you've got people who are identified as being on the right saying that the government, that's to say Trump, needs to get his people to get the people on the left because they assume that someone on the left has done it. Again, it seems to be at this stage another sniper assassination, someone in the distance who pretty good shot from perhaps from the roof of a building who takes someone out. It's thought out. But then again, Abraham Lincoln, I mean, that was thought out. It was done in the theatre. They knew where he was. They walked up and shot him. And they've been doing it, it seems, pretty much ever since in the United States. We've been sort of lucky in Australia, haven't we? I don't think there's been all that many political assassinations.
There've not been political assassinations like that, but I mean we've had acts of violence. Even that sovereign citizen in Victoria, that was a political act. He anti-authoritarian, shot two cops, etc. So it's there. I think it's not on the scale of the US. I think that our political culture is a little bit different, and that's why having robust political institutions really matters. And your passion and my passion, Michael, for integrity in public office, all of those things are small contributing factors to a system that we all subscribe to, that we need people to have faith in. But in the US, I think that there's a lot of structural problems in a democracy that lead people to have lack of faith in it. And when they don't have faith in democracy, then they start taking matters in their own hands. And that's been going on for some time.
I had enjoyed sitting down, perhaps inviting him to our podcast, a Charlie Kirk type person who have strong religious views underpinning their worldview to try and understand it better and to see what he thought of mine, which wouldn't necessarily agree with him on many topics. But there are those people who seem to believe that there's only one form of government that a country should have, and that you can't have any sort of plural views in politics. And they're not willing to accept that the Conservatives might be in charge at one point and the people on the left of centre might be in charge at another point. A lot of the time, I think it's the people in the middle in Australia who are running things. But when you've got someone who doesn't have an ability to accept that others can win office and do all they can when they do win office to wipe the others out, it doesn't augur well.
No, it doesn't augur well at all. If I can point out a really small example of your own work, Michael, you're currently been interviewing all five candidates for the Fremantle mayoral role. They're all different. They all have fairly divergent views. Some of your subscribers will may like one more than the other, but hopefully they listen to all five, get their hear their perspective, and make up their minds for themselves.
Well, a place where people seem to have made up their minds, black and white, is when you turn up again in Gaza, dealing with Hamas and Israel, seemingly took everyone by surprise and decided to fire into a building in Qatar, where they believe senior Hamas officials were and plainly killed some people. And it's just astonishing. I mean, apart from anything else, the intelligence that Israel always seems to act on to be able to pinpoint a room in a building almost to take their perceived opponents out is pretty stunning. But it goes against all the rules, doesn't it, of international law?
The disturbing thing about this is there's a number of disturbing things. One, Qatar has been the principal. I know that Israel will say they harbour Hamas leaders, which is true, but they're also, you need some place or some entity to host negotiations to actually, someone's got to bring people together. And Qatar has been the country that has sought to host and try and facilitate some form of peace negotiations between the two parties. And no matter how unpalatable your opposition is, someone's got to negotiate. And literally, those people were examining the terms that Israel and US and others had come up with when the bombs hit. At what point do we have to really question whether people really want peace? Because if you're bombing the actual peace people that are considering your proposals, I mean, where does it leave us? So I think there's some really profound and disturbing things. I'm curious about where the US sits in all of this because Qatar is a key ally of the US. They have their largest base in the Middle East is based there. They have very good relations. I would have thought that this is a very dis surely that's a disturbing development for Trump, I would have thought. It appears that he had little to no notice of it. There's a range of really disturbing aspects to this.
There can be no doubt, I think, now that Israel is not interested in achieving a negotiated diplomatic solution to what's happening in Gaza. The fear that we all, or many of us, had initially was that as a result of what happened nearly 2 years ago, Israel was not going to stop in its invasion of Gaza. And that's happening around us. The destruction of buildings is continuing to happen. This strike in Qatar has just happened. No notice to the US. And on that front, you're left with the strong impression, as I think the New York Times have suggested, that Trump is merely a spectator when it comes to Ukraine and Gaza. And I think being a spectator isn't necessarily a totally neutral position. It's standing back, it's hands off, and probably a deep breath as he has his toast and coffee in the morning and says, "Oh, well, whatever happens, happens."
I think he's tried before in terms of negotiating some form of peace, but I think he's found it too difficult. There's the choice for him is whether he just sort of steps back and lets it all go, or having committed to finding peace, whether he is actually prepared to up the ante on some of the combatants. Because if you really, he does actually have levers to force all of those parties to the table. And he's probably just about the only country that does have those levers. So if the US can't sort out Israel and Gaza, I don't think anyone can. He's probably the only one that has really significant levers left with Israel, for example.
I'd have little doubt, Martin, that the assassination of Charlie Kirk, an event like that, would actually hearten someone like Trump when it would come to the question of intervening in the Middle East.
Yeah, it does lead us to questions. Like I said, you had here's an example. He had put forward forms of peace proposals. He'd said that Israel had agreed to them. He's demanded that Hamas agrees to them, and then we've got the bombing of Hamas leaders who are considering the proposal. So where does that leave us, really? Because how can you expect Hamas to consider details of the proposal if they're actually being bombed in Qatar, which is where the negotiations are taking place? So that doesn't add up, really.
Well, Martin, you still don't believe we're on the eve of destruction? Rhetorical question, Martin. We'll come back to it. But it's been really fascinating in Australia this last week or so. We had Jacinta Price, who was once a National and then a Liberal and has strong views on many things, seemed always to quite like that MAGA bent in her own campaigning. Said some things which everybody except her took as saying nasty things about the Australian Indian community. And Susan Lee has just sacked her from the front bench. There are probably rumblings about Susan Lee again. I'm not sure. Jacinta Price, she apparently is going to be addressing a breakfast here in the Indian community. But has it been a sort of a lot of stuff about nothing? What's it emblematic of, Martin?
Firstly, I think it's emblematic of a challenge the Liberal Party faces, and that's that some of their members love the kind of rhetoric that Jacinta Price offers, fairly firebrand rhetoric, flying the flag in their view. But the rhetoric that she offers is very different and remote and sometimes completely contradictory to the groups of people they need to vote for them. This was a great example of that. So some people in the Liberal Party kind of like the fact that she's getting stuck in a mass migration, but in particular, sort of singling out that different migrant groups vote for Labor. But she went further than that. She actually said that Indian Australians were just being imported here so that they could vote for Labor, which is, I think, absolutely quite insulting to Indian Australians. And I don't think it's true. And it's not true that, firstly, I don't think it's true that any political party can do that. But secondly, Indian Australians vote in a whole range of different directions. A lot of them are entrepreneurs, a lot of them are small business owners. They're not just in Labor's pocket, they're very independent minded. So they were furious and outraged by this. And I think she could have resolved it simply by apologising. But she's kind of indicated that the remarks were misconstrued or used lots of different words, but never wanted to apologise. Which is astonishing in my view. And this is why it's blown up bigger than it should have.
Well, there was a one op-ed written by an Indian Australian man who said, "Well, I know that people will now be voting for Labor as a result of this."
If they were, this probably would turn them off, wouldn't it? It's quite insulting. It doesn't matter if you put any of our ethnic groups that we came from and said, "Well, you're just being imported in the country, so you vote for Labor." That's got to be offensive, hasn't it?
It's totally insulting, and it certainly make them think, well, perhaps we should if that's the way they're going to treat us. So what's Jacinta Price really on about? I mean, if you're her principal private campaign manager type person, I suppose any publicity is good publicity, and her name goes up in the lights and she'll be back on Sky News more often than usual. I mean, is that her aim?
I think she's a maverick, and I think she just believes that she can speak her mind, a bit Bob Catter-esque. Now, Bob Catter says a lot of crazy stuff, and because he's independent, seems to get away with it, doesn't matter. But Jacinta Price is a member of a mainstream political party, and she's also on the shadow cabinet of that political party,
She
which
was.
means you've got responsibilities. And I think she hasn't really grasped that side of things.
Well, I mean, what are the implications for Susan Lee trying to from her perspective, and the moderates in that party trying to get it back on a sort of a central footing, a fulcrum that means it doesn't, flip this way or that way too dramatically.
I think Suzanne Ley, who's a moderate by nature anyway, is trying to reposition the party in the centre right, a broad-based party that can appeal to the different demographics she needs to appeal to have a chance of winning, and to claw back some of the ground they've lost at the last election. That's her broader remit, I think. But she's facing some people in the membership and some people, particularly on her right flank, that believe the only reason why they've lost support is they haven't been as forthright as they should have been. They haven't been as demanding or as strident. They have the opposite view of the 2025 election. It's a very difficult one. She has got a lot of different people in her party to try and manage. She only just won the leadership battle over Angus Taylor, and there's a sense that there's a few people already quite happy to get rid of her.
Well, it's hot in the kitchen, as they say, Martin. And as you've adverted to earlier, it's pretty hot in the kitchen with the Fremantle mayoral and candidate elections. And five people standing for our mayor, and even in Fremantle, under the state rules, if you get a gift, you have to disclose it, Martin. There's been one gift disclosed in this local government election already. But the election returns have come in from the state election. Have you had a look at them?
I have, and they tell a fascinating story, I've got to say. They float in however many months after the election, everyone's moved on, but they will tell you the story about who's got what money. And money does matter because that's what you use to make your campaign visible, etc. And the first headline act is that the Labor Party, it's the amount of money that it raised and the amount of money that it spent far exceeded the Liberal Party, and that obviously gave them an edge. I don't think I would go as far to say as that was the sole reason why for victory, but money helps. In fact, some people might argue it's because everyone thought that they were going to win that they were able to raise more money. So they spent a lot more money than the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party spent a lot more money than the National Party. The Greens actually spent less than half a million, which is quite a low amount. So that's the headline act. For independents, there were two independents that raised a significant amount of money. And you might note that those same two independents are the two independents that performed the best, Kate Hewlett and Rachel Horncastle.
Fascinating, Martin, and I interviewed both of those independent candidates during the elections for Fremantle Shipping News, and they raised significant sums of money. Everyone said so in relation to Kate Hewlett at the time, but she had total gifts received of $143,153.67, and the total elect expenditure less than that, so you've got a bit in the kitty, presumably $106,074.29. I mean, it's a big amount of money.
Absolutely. For an independent, that was way more than the nearest other independent, Rachel Horncastle, was 64,000. So that's way over the nearest next highest amount. And then there's a big drop to all the other independent and micro party candidates. So she clearly had more resources, but that also probably links to the strength of her support base and overall campaign. There were donations from Climate 200 to both those candidates, which would have helped, I'm sure.
It is interesting just to look at total electoral expenditure. You finish up with the Labor Party, you adverting to this really, at nearly $11 million,
Million.
$10,933,315.45. Who comes the closest to that?
Well, the Liberal Party have 3.8 million. So 10.9 million versus 3.8 million. Now,
Just
even if you add the Nats there, you still have less than 5 million between the Liberal and National parties who don't campaign together, by the way, at state level. Big. And Greens did spend a little over half a million, so 527,000, I should
And the
say.
National was 888,000. As you say, the Greens did pretty well. The Animal Justice Party rounded up $53,000 in contributions. It's really quite interesting to look at it. The Christians did better than that. They had 166,000, Martin. But it's interesting to see the figures. But you want to know where they come from. Where did all the money come from to have the expenditure?
Oh well, likewise, we've got donation figures. They're not included here, but we've got a better understanding of donations since the reforms came through around political donation disclosure. So we can go and look at that separately. The other point that I'd make here is around electoral reimbursement, and some parties did all right there in terms of reimbursement. So Paul and Hanson's One Nation, for instance. They got $78,000 back from the Electoral Commission, which is really public funding.
Explain to our listeners how they get that. What's
Well,
the
it's $4.40 per first preference vote. So every time they get a vote direct to One Nation, they get $4.40. There's a few technical aspects that they've got to get 4% of the electorate that they're voting in. So in the upper house, for
then they
instance,
get the
then
reimbursement.
they get the reimbursement. So that's a sizable figure, given that they don't appear to have actually spent much money. So there's the odd party that that can make money out of these things. I mean, a lot of the time it costs them money. But the Greens only got 483,000 back, even though they spent they had a lot more first party a lot more primary votes than the Nationals.
The other interesting expenditure area, which often gets forgotten about, are the so-called third-party campaigners that you or I, Martin, or you and I decide that we want to get out there and beat the drum for whatever we think's important, filling the potholes currently all around the roads of Fremantle after the heavy rains in recent months. So that's it, and we want to campaign on that topic, and we might want to spend as much as we like. We've become familiar in Australia with the big PACs in the United States, which are apparently independent, but not really. But look down the list here of the third party campaigners and who spent lots and lots of money.
Well, there were some big figures there. And then I guess the question is, what were they hoping to achieve? So your biggest figures on this list are the Fishing Families WA Association that spent almost $400,000,
Amazing.
$397,000 on the campaign.
I have to tell you, I can't remember exactly what that group were backing, and when it comes to advertising or the like.
I don't remember seeing much from them, so I'm not sure where that money went. I'm assuming that they're campaigning hard for fishing rights. I would have thought for recreational fishing. You've got Welga that spent 290,000.
There's a local government organisation.
That's right, Peakbody for local government. I think that there probably is something there. They would have spent a lot of that money to help presumably campaign for more funding for various aspects of local government roads and all that kind of stuff. So. That's a sizable amount of money. That probably makes a bit more sense.
Didn't see the environment groups coming out with specific targets. The Environs Kimberley are battling about all sorts of things up there, I think, including around Fitzroy with water. But they spent just over, well, nearly $53,500. It's not insignificant. And similarly, the Lock the Gate Alliance, which is another environmental advocacy group, spent nearly $47,000. They're interesting to look at, isn't it? I guess you knew so at the time if you were watching the advertising, but this helps to confirm it.
It is really helpful for us. I'm a big believer in transparency in this area. And the more information we have, the more we can make comments, critique, perhaps explain to people why decisions are made in the way that they have been.
Now, just so if people are looking at this, help us out. You see in front of some candidates' names, TPC, Kate Hewlett, TPC, Rachel Horncastle. It's obviously not them personally, but what's the TPC?
They're third-party campaigners, so they're people campaigning alongside a candidate.
And that's a good way to associate it. It's not just blogs. You wouldn't know who blogs was. Well,
And it makes sense because otherwise we don't know who they're working with.
As you say, we haven't sought to look at the individual donors in this discussion. How do you, as someone who's been close to these reforms coming in, see them working? Are they doing what they were meant to do?
I think we've got a much better understanding around political donations than we used to have. The 1 week disclosure rules make sense. I probably would have preferred that they went as low as $1,000 in terms of threshold for disclosure. The threshold's higher than that, but it's definitely been a big step in the right direction. I'd prefer to see this kind of data come out earlier than it has.
Well, is there any chance that there can be some tinkering with those sorts of regulatory requirements? I mean, why can't they bring it out sooner? They've got it all. They go straight into the computer. They have to meet the 7 day rules. Surely they could give you a return, within 14 days of the election.
You would think so. I can't myself see an impediment to getting this out within 14 days of the election. And it helps us contextualise an election result because you see where the money's gone.
Well, Martin, it is interesting, and we'll keep watching it. I'll keep an eye out for who else contributes at the local government level in Fremantle. People probably don't realise they have an obligation to do it, although the returning officer of the local government no doubt is reminding all of the candidates that they need to. Well, it's been another tumultuous day in the world, another tumultuous week in the world, Martin. As you can tell, I'm really a little perplexed and puzzled. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? I think we all can, actually, but yeah. And you and the generations ahead have to keep battling with it, Martin.
Well, I hope that we learn from these things. I'm not sure we will, but I hope that we learn from these things. I would hope that, say, in the US, for instance, that political leaders come together and try to commit to to looking at the rhetoric, the decision, the way that they try and conduct themselves, to try and unify people rather than tear each other apart.
Well, that's the hope and the promise of diplomacy and people having a proper view of humanity. But in many ways, Cain and Abel started it all. People were cleaning up each other long before Alexander the Great went up and down. And Martin, I have absolutely no confidence they'll stop. But on that pessimistic note, I'll allow you to say something optimistic, and then we'll say goodbye to our listeners.
Well, encourage all your listeners to get out and vote in the local government elections coming up. We'll be putting out some information for our own debate that Michael and I are both involved in. And for local people, we hope we see you there. But for everyone else, I think there's always another week, there's always another story. And we'll get back to you with a few positive ones, Michael.
All right, we'll have a positive week, 1 week. Jeez, that's going to be difficult. Thanks, Mark. It's been lovely chatting.
Always a pleasure.